You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of my best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I really wanted to talk about friendships, and specifically the types of friendships that are always troubled by the fact that the other person is, like, on occasion, or maybe sometimes even, like, quite often, like, a racist person. And, you know, when you're a person of color who lives in the West, where you live in majority white countries, it's kind of going to be inevitable that some of the people who you call friends or who you associate with or who you are acquaintances with are going to display some forms of racism. And when that happens, especially when they are a close friend, it obviously leads you to, like, this crossroads where you're trying to weigh up the benefits of the friendship, you're trying to weigh up, like, the positive sides of the person. And a lot of the time there's many positive sides. The person might be a kind person, a generous person, a thoughtful person. They might come from a very nice family. They might have all these other positive attributes that you like about them, which is why when racism kind of rears its ugly head, it can be really confusing, because again, you don't want to toss aside this person who you like in all these other ways, because there's one part of their character that is, shall we say, flawed. So that's what I want to talk about in this episode. And I thought about it this week or over the last few weeks, because I had a very good friend who's recently come back into my life, and we stopped speaking because he'd said something incredibly offensive to me, something racist. And I just said at the time, listen, let's take a break. I just can't do this right now. And he came back to me. This is like 2 years ago, out of the blue, 2 years later, writes me a really long, thoughtful message apologizing for what happened and essentially asking if we could be friends again. And I've tried my hardest to be as objective and as, like, measured as I can. So for this episode, I've written 5 pros of remaining in these types of friendships, and I've written 5 cons of, you know, the downsides of staying in this kinds of relationships. And at the end, I'm going to talk about my takeaways. But before I go into that, a couple of things. The first is I've got a cold, which is why I sound terrible. And the second thing is I want to clarify what I mean by, like, the kinds of racism where you might even consider remaining friends with somebody. So I'm obviously not talking about the kinds of racism where anybody would do anything physically harmful to you. I'm also not talking about the kind of racism where anybody would ever use any type of racial slur against you or in your presence. So, like, think of things, like, things that are clearly unacceptable are things where if you were to, like, go to an HR department and say, my colleague said so-and-so, like, said this and that, they would get reprimanded for that. Like, that's quite obvious forms of racism. I'm talking about the kinds of racism that kind of takes place in friendships and interpersonal friendships where there's, like, it's an interracial dynamic, like, one person's a person of color, the other person's white. And these take more the form of, like, you have to, like, think about it. Like, they say something, it rubs you the wrong way, but often you don't actually realize in the moment that what they said is racist until you go and you think about why it has bothered you so much. So I'll give you, like, a few examples that have happened in my life. So this one time I was talking to, like, a friend of mine, and I was talking about going to an event, some kind of, like, work event or work function. And at that work function, I had met, like, a Nigerian princess who had introduced herself as a Nigerian princess. And she'd told me a little bit about, like, where she's from or what region in Nigeria she's from and what her family do. But I don't remember the details now, but I was just recounting that story. And I remember saying something innocuous. Maybe I was talking about how good she looked, or I was talking about, like, the function. And I just mentioned that in passing. But my friend, my, like, white friend at the time, really latched on to the fact that I had said that she's a Nigerian princess. And she said that obviously that's not true. And I said, oh, what do you mean that's not true? What part of what I just said is not true? And she basically said that she couldn't be a princess because she's Nigerian. And then I was kind of like, but, like, what do you mean? And obviously I was being, like, semi-facetious. Like, I already knew what she meant. without even having to like ask like those sort of questions to clarify. And essentially what she meant was she believed that only white countries basically can have princesses, because she doesn't consider the kings and queens or other royal members of non-white nations to be legitimate, essentially. Like, you could couch it in other language, but that's essentially what was at the core of her disbelief in what I had said about the woman that I met who had introduced herself as a Nigerian princess. Because bear in mind, she doesn't know this woman. So it's not as though she's questioning the legitimacy of the woman based on knowing her and knowing her family. She was saying simply that only, like, white countries have legitimate princesses and princes and kings and queens. So that's an example of like somebody says something and it rubs you the wrong way, and you have to sort of like do a little bit of prodding to realize why it's an offensive thing to say. Or another example, this one time I was staying with a friend and I was brushing my hair. Like, my hair is natural at the time. I wasn't in braids, it was out. And I was brushing my hair, and sometimes like little coily curls obviously break off when you're using a hair comb. And he picks up one of like the curly hairs and he kind of like stretches it, and he seems like really like curious about it, like really fascinated by the hair. And he's looking at it and he's stretching it and he's seeing how much it coils and how much it like goes back to its like contracted form when he lets it go. And he says something like, wow, I can't believe this is what the original people look like, or this is what we used to look like. And the way that he's saying it is in the sense of he's trying to say like, this is what we were when we were primitive. And I know that that's the meaning that he had when he said it, because straight after he recognizes his mistake, because in his mind, as he's saying it, he's essentially thinking that my hair type is the primitive hair type and we have evolved to have hair type like his hair type, white hair type. And because he's like a smart guy, he literally makes the correction in real time, and he basically kind of shakes his head and he's like, oh no, I've got it backwards. And I know what he has backwards, although he doesn't say it out loud, is that obviously because we know that all Homo sapiens, all humans evolved from Africans, from Africa, from the continent, it obviously doesn't make sense for him to imply that I would be the one who'd be less genetically evolved. It would be him, because he would be the one who came into being later, if that makes sense. So anyway, I see him make the correction in real life, in real time, but at no point does he apologize, by the way, for that casual racism. But again, it's the kind of thing where like the person says it and you're kind of like taken aback why his mind would even go that sort of anthropological route anyway. But you also realize what the implication of what he was saying is. And so it isn't until you sit down, you really analyze, like, what about what he said, how he said it, the things he said afterwards, why all those things amount to what in fact was what he was saying. So again, it's like an example of like, it's not explicit. Like, you have to sit down and analyze why you feel like you've just experienced a microaggression. Because again, like, I just don't feel like 2025 racism is like somebody walking up to you and like calling you the N-word, or like throwing things at you on the street. It's like a lot more insidious. And I think that's why it is so confusing, like being a person of color living in like a white country or in the West, why it's so confusing, like knowing where to draw the line with these things, you know? Because it'd be very easy if somebody like used a racial slur against you, like you could immediately dismiss them without having to sort of really analyze or compose a pros and cons list like I am doing here. So anyway, going into the pros and cons list then, and pros being why it is worthwhile still being friends with people who are on occasion exhibit like racist views or racist thoughts or racist like lines of thought. And the first one is that I think you'll often find that people who you are friends with who on occasion say things that are racist or say things that are by implication racist, you will notice that often when you call them out or you call them in or you tell them why they hurt you, they'll often show you that they are, one, sorry, and two, that there's a general desire and a will to change. And especially when you get older, you realize that like it's actually a lot easier to walk away than to apologize. So when people like piss you off for whatever reason, or they upset you or they hurt you, because we live in such like a disconnected world, especially when you live in a big city, like if you wanted to, you could like stop being friends with somebody and you would never see them again, because you have to make a conscious effort to be with each other, to see each other in a big place, in a big city like London, for example. And so when somebody does something to hurt you and they apologize, instead of just sort of like disappearing or ghosting or just like sort of fading out of your life, it, to some extent it speaks to their character in that they've chosen the more difficult path, and that difficult path being the path that is trying to make amends, trying to be better, trying to show you that they have a will to change and a will to try to be better. That's like a more difficult path, and that in itself is commendable. And even in our romantic relationships, like people often say, like, it isn't so much that what hurts people isn't so much that the person messes up or makes mistakes or does things that are hurtful. What hurts people, or what often causes people to let go or to end relationships, is the fact that the other person doesn't seem to display any desire or will to change. They don't display any desire to meet you halfway, or any desire to learn how to love you better, or how to be a better person for you, a better partner to you, or a better friend to you. And so going back to this friend example, where they've done or said something that is either explicitly sort of like a microaggression or a racist in some way, or the implication of what they're saying is racist, when they're the kind of person who apologizes meaningfully and they tell you about how their minds were working and how it was actually just being thoughtless as opposed to being malicious, like a part of that is commendable in that there is something endearing about somebody who is genuinely sorry and is genuinely trying to be better. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to get it right 100% of the time. It doesn't mean that they're not going to like not say something else that might be offensive in the future. It just means that they recognize in that moment that they've hurt you and that they're sorry about what they did and that they're going to try their hardest not to do or say things like that again. So that's the first pros of staying friends with somebody who can be prone to like doing things that are microaggressive or racist by implication, or racist by, you know, explicitly racist, is that that will to change is something that you don't see as much as you get older, because again, it is so much easier to walk away in a lot of circumstances. So it's honorable from that perspective that they're trying to be better for the sake of your relationship. Now, the second reason why it's worthwhile potentially maintaining these relationships is that it's all very well and good to say, like, the minute somebody says something that is microaggressive or racist or bigoted in some other way, that they are dead to us and we're going to cut them off. There's a counter argument to say that in order for change to take place, you kind of have to bring along everybody. Like, you have to allow space for people to make mistakes and to be able to learn from those mistakes without necessarily being outcast or being made like persona non grata or being like ostracized from like society or from your social circle. Because ultimately what you do when you ostracize them or when you isolate them, when you freeze them out, is that I don't know if they are as inclined to reflect upon what they did and make those positive changes. Because a lot of the time, the easier thing to do is to make yourself the victim. So instead of them being invited into the conversation about what they've said or done and how that's offensive, because they've been outcast and basically like being excommunicated, if you will, from your social network or from your social group, it's a lot easier for them to take up like the victim narrative, where they essentially feel like hard done by because they in their minds have done something bad unintentionally, which means that they view themselves as a good person who's made a mistake. And in the face of that, they've essentially faced like extreme penalization. And that extreme penalization in their eyes is the fact that they've been excommunicated for what is to them a simple mistake. So I think most of the time when we like excommunicate people or we ice them out of our lives, I genuinely think they tend to take the victim route. And as far as trying to like guarantee the best outcome for ourselves, and that best outcome presumably being an outcome in which there is less racism in the world, presumably you have to take some of those racists with us to like reduce some of their racism. And I look at it from the perspective of like people aren't perfect across the board in all these different avenues. This just happens to be another area in which people are not perfect. And as long as they're not doing like dangerous things or like extremely harmful things, like you can, there are things that are teachable. There are things where you can break down things for people and show them how what they are saying is offensive and why. So an example of something that people say, like white people say, and these are white people who probably consider themselves good people and in fact probably are good people, but they say it without recognizing sometimes that it's offensive or that it's racist or bad thing to say. And that's when they say things like, I don't see color, or I think we all bleed the same on the inside, or I don't care if you're like black or white or striped or purple or spotted, basically things to that effect. They're basically saying like color doesn't matter to me. Now, because we live in a racialized world, obviously it's not helpful to say to a person of color you don't see their color, because one, that's a lie, you do. You've got eyes. If you can distinguish between sexes, you can look at a person and know that one person's male, one person's female. You can look at a person and see that one person's blonde, one person's brunette. You can look at a person and see that one person has an afro, one person has braids. You can look at a person and see that one person's wearing heels or the one person's wearing flats. You can look at a person and see that their eye color is green and the person's color is brown. Why would you not be able to distinguish that one person has brown skin and the other person has peach skin? That's a silly thing to say. It's clearly untrue. The second thing is, apart from it just being clearly untrue, is that racialized people are racialized in the white world. And so because they've been racialized, they face all kinds of things, negative things a lot of the time, because of that racialization. And so when you say things like, I don't see color, you're essentially like minimizing the importance that race plays in all our lives to the detriment of people of color. You're kind of by implication saying that race doesn't matter. And although philosophically it shouldn't matter, and if people of color had it their way, it wouldn't matter, in practice, it does matter. It matters all the time. It matters in the hiring process. It matters in the justice process. It matters in the interpersonal relationship dynamics that I'm talking about now. It matters in all kinds of ways. It matters in Black women's mortality rates, in childbirth. It matters in all kinds of ways. So when you say things like, I don't see color, or we all are the same to me, it doesn't matter if you're Black, white, blue, that's complete nonsense, and you're completely erasing the significance of race dynamics for the people of color and how that impacts their lives. So anyway, my point being, you can break down, as I just did, for somebody you care about and explain to them why actually that's not a nice thing to say, or it's not a productive thing to say, or it's not a helpful thing to say, and give them alternatives of what they can say that is more supportive or helpful or doesn't deny the importance of race and the existence of racism by implication. You can break that down, and I guarantee most of the time when you have somebody who's like amenable and you have somebody who cares about you and you've told them why that's offensive and why that's hurtful or why that's not helpful, if you explain that to them, chances are like you probably won't have to explain that to them again. And so in like a small way, you've had an impact in their worldview, or at least as far as this topic is concerned. And chances are you'll find that they spread the word to other people that they come across. You know, they'll be probably pretty keen to show off their new knowledge in a way. And so again, it's an example of like, you've corrected somebody in a kind way, in a way where you've you haven't like not held them accountable, you've held them accountable. But if you've broken things down, and because you've broken things down and they've understood and they've come to the conversation with an open heart and with love for you, you can essentially bring them along the journey. So they haven't had to be discarded by the wayside. They've been brought along and they've got, you know, the potential, I would say, to do like good in the future, either by just being better to you and being better to other people of color because they don't say things like that anymore, or even just by telling their fellow like microaggressors why that's an offensive thing to say. So either way, you can bring them along, and usually that's for the better. Now, the third reason why I think it's worthwhile maintaining these relationships sometimes is, I think if we're honest, we do that anyway in other contexts for people that we love. And by that, I mean that we extend grace all the time to other people. So we all have like a homophobic uncle or a homophobic grandparent or like a bigoted auntie in some other respect, or like a sexist father, or not my father, but in general, or like a sexist brother, or a classist mother. So in all these other different forms of like bigotry, we probably have people who we hold dear, who we love, who we would never like throw away or give up on or like quit because they exhibit these behaviors. And confronted with these behaviors, when we see the homophobia in our family or the sexism in our family or the classism in our family, what we do is we tend to, again, like in the previous point that I just made, we tend to like bring them along with us. We tend to correct them and say, no, mom, you can't say this. No, Uncle Steve, you can't say that. Or no, dad, you can't say that. Like most of the time we extend grace, and over time of like correcting, of calling out, of holding them accountable, they learn. So because we do that anyway with people that we like, other people that we care about, other people that we hold dear, it'll be a bit hypocritical to say that we accept all these other forms of bigotry in our lives, or not accept, we are willing to work with people when they display all these other bigotries in our lives, but somehow like this one, this racism one, is the one where it's like, you're dead to me, like you're thrown away. Like there has to be a little bit of consistency, I think. Now, the fourth and second last reason where I think there are pros in maintaining friendships with people who might say or do racist things from time to time or display microaggressions. And by the way, microaggressions is just a polite way to say like small forms of racism, in case anybody wasn't clear on that or in case I was being ambiguous. But the fourth reason is that I think once people are essentially like shown the light, and by that I mean once you show them a worldview that challenges how they've been socialized to see the world, often it can be a very transformative experience for them, because it's almost like you're wearing sunglasses, like really dark sunglasses your whole life, and then somebody takes them off for you, and then suddenly you see the world in like all these vibrant colors. And sometimes when you expose somebody to like the fact that they were thinking in a warped way, so for example, they had like these like inbuilt sort of like racist ideas or views or viewpoints or implications, sometimes like once you show that to them, it's like it energizes them, like it completely transforms them. And I would say it transforms them in a way that is deeper than somebody who's always known that. Because for them, it's like they've gone all this time and then suddenly somebody has just given them like something that's just completely changed their worldview. That shocks the system a lot more than somebody who's always known that. And because that shocks the system a lot more, and it feels more of like a defined pivot in their lives, it can often mean that they're just more like impassioned about the thing. They're more impassioned about the new discovery. They're more impassioned about this thing that they have just learned. And that can really manifest in them being like stronger allies, being more vocal allies, being more activist in the way that they approach life going forward. And in terms of like having that experience of somebody showing you something where you were thinking in a warped way or in like a backward way, and then somebody says something to you that just completely shifts your worldview, I've personally had that experience as well. I used to think about like rape culture in a way that was rapey myself. So I remember once we were watching this documentary, my partner and I were watching this documentary, and it was a documentary on where they were surveying like young adults, maybe like sub 21, maybe even like, maybe they were like 19, 20. I think they were definitely outside of like secondary school or high school, but they definitely weren't like, hadn't graduated. So let's say they were like 20 years old, but they were asking boys and girls, men and women, what they thought about different subjects to do with sex, different subjects to do with rape culture, different subjects to do with rape in general. And one of the things that they were, that the group got stuck on, which is something that I got stuck on at the time, and in my defense, by the way, I was like 22, so this is not me now, but I said something, they were saying something like, they gave a scenario in which a girl went to a party and she did a lot of drinking at the party, and she had gone there to actually meet up with this guy that she fancied. She didn't end up seeing him because he didn't show up or something, but she got super wasted and she started flirting with somebody else, with some other guy. Anyway, long story short, they, at some point during the evening, the guy and the girl end up being in a bedroom upstairs at like this party that they're at, and one thing leads to another and they have sex. The girl the next day wakes up, and she's at her own home, and she has no recollection of the evening really, because she was so wasted. And when she starts piecing together the evening, she remembers that she had sex with this guy, but she didn't remember like going upstairs. She didn't remember any of the sexual acts. She didn't remember anything because she was that wasted. Now, the question that was asked of the group was whether this encounter was consensual. And it really divided the group, because some of the group were saying, of course it was consensual because she liked him, because she was flirting with him, she was drinking with him all night long, she went upstairs with him. In terms of like the actual act, there was no bruises on her body. She didn't say she was injured. She didn't say she was fighting him. It just sounds like two people who had drunk sex and she woke up and she didn't remember it. But that's not the same thing as not having consensual sex. And then the other side were saying how, because she was that wasted and because she didn't recall or remember any of the encounter, because she couldn't even piece together like the evening and how it went, clearly she was in no position to consent. Now, at the time, 22-year-old me was with the former camp, in that I was very adamant. I was like, well, you know, ultimately they are both two young people who are both drinking a lot of alcohol, and they've both decided to go upstairs. And so if she liked him and she was flirting with him and she's going upstairs to a room with him, how can she not know that it's going to lead to sex? Why would you leave a crowded party and go to a room where it's just you two if you don't intend to have some form of intimacy? And on top of that, you know, there's no bruises on her body. She's not injured. She's not cut. It's like, obviously, the sex was consensual. Otherwise, there would be physical evidence of the fact that it wasn't consensual, i.e. there would be injuries. Now, what my partner said to me that like completely transformed like how I think about rape and non-consensual sex and alcohol and consent is that you cannot consent if you're wasted. And the reason for that is very simple, is that when you are wasted to the point where you literally don't even remember what happened the previous day, it means that for several hours before you go to sleep, before you wake up, like having blanked out, there's loads of things that are taking place where you are out of control. You're not processing the situation properly. You don't understand what's going on. You don't understand the person's motive. You can be easily led. Like when somebody's drunk, they're like a child. You can get them to do all kinds of things because they're not in their right mind. You could ask them to give you loads of money. The reason why people injure themselves and get themselves into dangerous situations when they're drunk is because, again, they're not in their conscious minds. They're not in their thinking minds. They're out of control. They don't have control over their like bodies. Like when you see somebody who's incredibly inebriated, as this person would have had to be to have woken up like having blacked out the next day, they can't even walk straight. They're slurring their words. They can't process thoughts properly. Never mind being able to understand that they're going upstairs now. that they're going upstairs with a stranger, that the stranger might have intentions that they are not comfortable or happy with. And also, at the time, I didn't really understand the concept that there are different forms of rape, because the way that rape takes place in films is that it's often like at gunpoint or with the threat of violence or actual violence. But there's all kinds of sexual violence or all kinds of rape. Rape, for example, where the person or the perpetrator is known to the victim, often doesn't take place in the same way that like stranger danger rape is depicted or takes place. Often it isn't accompanied necessarily by that like form of violence. But obviously, it doesn't mean that it isn't rape. So anyway, long story short, like at the time, I just had a poor or a young person's understanding of the fact that there's different types of rapes, or the fact that you literally cannot consent when you're drunk because you're not able to think. You can't walk, you can't think straight, you're cognitively impaired. For the purposes of consent, in that time that you're inebriated, you're like a child, like you can be led to do anything. And so my point here, going back to like the friends and the pros of keeping certain problematic friendships, is that I obviously learned that lesson very well. And ever since I learned that lesson, because my partner was patient with me and explained it in a very kind way, you know, I'm a big advocate of believing women, for example, of not minimizing people's experiences or reading into situations. Or, for example, like when I see, I'm the kind of person who I will call the police for a lot of things. And one of those things is if I see a drunk girl like at a station, like a tube station, or walking in a dangerous way, or accompanied by people who I just feel like something is off, I will call the police straight away and I will wait until they arrive. And so all of that is because my partner taught that to me, like taught me that. And so going back to what I was saying about the pros of staying in friendships where the person might be prone to making microaggressive comments or other bigoted comments in some way, I think when you are able to get through to them and when you are able to teach them like lesson by lesson, often you find that they become like the biggest advocates of that lesson. They pass it on. They seem rejuvenated by the fact that you've taught them something incredibly meaningful and something that has changed fundamentally how they view things. And that has or can have the net effect of them being just incredibly vocal and active allies, as I said. Now, the final reason I will say of, we'll talk about on the pro side of why it can be like good or helpful or beneficial or worthwhile staying friends with people who have exhibited microaggressions to you in the past, or bigoted or covertly bigoted comments to you in the past, is that like when you forgive them and you're able to sort of like move forward, like one of the benefits to you personally at a, like just to you, is you get to like put down your anger. Because when people do you wrong or they hurt you and you have to take like an active stance against them, like I'm cutting you out of my life or I'm not talking to you anymore or you're dead to me, it actually like exerts so much energy on you, on your person. It feels like it's an effort to maintain that anger, to maintain that sort of nemesis or nemesis status with that person. You know, when they come up in conversation, you have to like ignore them or change the subject or like not contribute. When you're walking around and you think about the happy memories you had together, you have to like stifle them down and remember that you know, still hate the person or you're still angry with the person. Or, you know, when you see pictures of them on social media, you know, it feels heavy. It feels heavy for you. Like every time you're reminded of them or you're around them or people speak about them, it feels heavy because you're still heavy with that anger or that disappointment or that frustration with them. And so the pros of sort of forgiving and moving on with that person is you get to put that down. You know, you get to like ease your mind and like unburden yourself from having to carry that anger and frustration and disappointment and sort of like enjoy like lighter, happier times with the person. Now, initially, I will say when I was thinking about the pros of the list, I had to dig deep. I had to really think, because my initial, especially because I'm thinking about my own situation right now, and often when you're annoyed about something or something is like, you know, on your mind in a negative way, you can only focus on the bad stuff. So I had to dig deep, but the more I spoke about them and the more I like thought about the positives, actually they kind of came to me like easier after the first couple. So with that being said though, I obviously do have to go into the cons. And with the cons, I will say there are three, I was going to say five, but I'm just going to say three because they're kind of, I could make them longer, but let me be more concise because my throat is killing me. The first reason why it's a major con in maintaining friendships with people who are bigoted or who display microaggressions or racism, even if it is in like a lower level, quote unquote, way, is that even when you do choose to forgive them, you have to recognize that people in general don't live in vacuums and they tend to be like the sum total of their environment. And so if someone is racist or bigoted in some other way, you can be damn sure that like they come from a long line of bigotry and racism, because these social issues, like these social characteristics, if you will, are things that are inherited. So nobody's born like racist, nobody's born homophobic, nobody's born sexist. They're made by the people in their lives. They're made by their family members initially, by their parents, by their extended family members. And these behaviors and these traits tend to be incredibly deeply embedded in their social circle. And so it'll display in like the kinds of friends that they have. It'll display in the kinds of books that they read and the kinds of films or TV shows that they watch. It'll have like a self-reinforcing mechanism where they come from a long line of bigotry, and the things that they therefore like tend to have components of bigotry, and the people in their lives tend to approve or co-sign or not disapprove of that bigotry. And so it has the effect of reinforcing the socialized bigotry. So you see where I'm going with this. It tends to be like when you see like a display of like microaggression or racism or other forms of bigotry, often it's like the fin, it's like the shark's fin sticking up over the water. And so you can think it's just a very small issue, but actually below the waterline, below the surface, the problem tends to be a lot deeper than you realize. And there's a reason why they say, you know, an apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, and because that's true. You see the apple and you think it's just the apple, but actually no, the apple comes from like a freaking tree. A tree with loads of apples that are similar in the way that they view life. And so again, like it can be tempting to see your relationship in an isolated way, like this is me and my friend having an interpersonal issue. But actually, if you look behind them, if you look past the person behind them and you interrogate or investigate their wider network and wider social sphere of influence, you will see that it's not just them, it's probably their family members, their other friends, their other network. It's like a deeply ingrained thing. So even if you forgive them in this particular instance, if you continue to have them in your life, chances are you're going to meet their extended family and friends, and chances are you're going to see that they too have those same values or ethos or ways of looking at life. And so you are going to experience those same microaggressions or racism or bigotry from not just them, but their extended family. And also it means that even when you teach them things like I spoke about in my pros list, chances are at least like some of that work that you've done will be eroded, because again, you are not the only influence on their lives or their outlook or their perspective or their values. They also have like all these other people that they know and love and have probably known for longer than you and love more than you, influencing them and their outlook and their perspective and their worldview. And so you're kind of in a fight. You're trying to fight down their bigotry and their microaggression and their racism, but you're not just fighting that, you're also fighting all the people in their lives that influence them to think and behave and believe the way that they do. Now, the second con of forgiving people like this and maintaining relationships with them is that It's kind of like a foregone conclusion or inevitable that they're going to hurt you again. Because like I said, there's all these negative influences in their lives that's deeply embedded in their life, in their culture, in their background, in their familial ties, in their other friendships. And so, you know, there's a push and pull between how they'd like to be with you or the intentions they might have with you and the positive will and the positive desire to change they might have to maintain your relationship and to not hurt you. But then they're also being pulled by this counterweight of their experiences and their influences from their other friends and their family members. And then on top of that, there's an internal battle that you don't see, because when you, like, we tend to be or tend to reflect the environment that we grew up in. And so when we are trying to fight that environment and be new people, it's always an ongoing fight within ourselves. And this is true of all contexts. Even when you think about people who grew up in homes, for example, where there was an absent family member, they can understand intellectually the impact that that has on somebody. So they can know on an intellectual level that when you're a child who grew up in a home where there was like emotional neglect and like absence or like non-participation in your life, it can mean that you're a real people pleaser. It can mean that in romantic relationships, you don't have high standards for yourself, that you let people mistreat you, that you let people take advantage of you. You might also understand that it leads people in your situation to overcompensate and give too much to the point where it's hurting you, but you feel like the only way to like keep people to you is by giving them whatever they want. So you can understand this at an intellectual level, but you still exhibit those negative behaviors. You still do those things from time to time or often, because even though you know something intellectually, it's very different from being able to put it into practice, especially when it's something that's been deeply ingrained from childhood till adulthood. And especially when that thing was ingrained by really influential people in your lives, in your life. So if those values were placed there by experiences or family members or other loved ones, it becomes a much harder thing to try and fight. And so going back to the person who wants to do better for you and wants to do better so that your relationship can be better and so they don't hurt you, who you have taught these things and explained why certain things are offensive and why they shouldn't say or do those things, they can understand it at an intellectual level. They can understand what you're saying. They could have all the will and the desire to make those changes. But again, there's still an ongoing internal struggle within themselves where they're trying to like fight against their social conditioning and conditioning that their environment has sort of placed on them or has turned them into. They're trying to fight that all at all times. And it's not necessarily the case that you're going to win a lot of the time or most of the time or every time. And so what that means is that it is literally inevitable or a foregone conclusion, as I said before, that they're going to hurt you again. And by the way, with this hurting you again point, it actually goes a lot deeper, because it'd be one thing if they hurt you and then you corrected them on a different issue. So it's like you've gotten past the I don't see color conversation. And so the next time they hurt you, it isn't on that front, or it's on something else. So you can correct them on that new thing. But the problem is that the way that I believe the human beings behave is that the more you forgive them for things, the less importance they place on disappointing you in a way. So by that, I mean, like, maybe the first time they say something that's a microaggression, that's a racist or that's bigoted, you are offended and you correct them. And because it's the first time you've corrected them and it's the first time they've offended you, and they fear losing your friendship and they fear being branded a racist and they fear sort of you not being friends with them, essentially, they're going to be like really afraid and want to make those changes and like be really keen to show you that they're sorry and show you that they're keen to make changes and they're never going to do it again. But because the nature of racism is that it's deeply ingrained, it's that it's socialized, it's that it forms part of the fabric of who the person is and how their mind works, it means that it's going to happen over and over and over and over again. It also means that you're going to have to forgive them over and over and over again. And whilst that might not necessarily like be terrible, the terrible thing is that with apologies, for the person, for the recipient of the forgiveness, of the person who you forgive, the more you forgive them, the less your forgiveness means to them. It's kind of like the chronic cheater. The cheater, the first time they cheat on you and you catch them and you threaten to leave or you show that you're furious and you might leave, they are besides themselves with fear that you're going to leave. They're so apologetic. They're so sorry. They never want to hurt you again. They never want to disappoint you in that way again. And for a time they don't. But when they do it again and again and again, and you forgive them again and again, guess what happens? They don't take your emotions seriously. They don't fear losing you. They are less apologetic, less truly sorry each time that you forgive them. And it's the same thing with this as well, where because it's inevitable that they will hurt you again, and because you will therefore need to forgive them for you to be friends, the more time you forgive them, the less your forgiveness means to them. Which ultimately means that with each incident of bigotry or microaggression or racism that takes place, the racism in their minds is reduced into being a smaller and smaller and smaller deal. Because it's sort of like, if you've forgiven me for the last 25 microaggressions, the microaggressions can't mean that much, or they can't be that bad, or it can't be that awful. And they might not say it in those terms explicitly, but you will sense it in how low effort each preceding apology will feel like. Like, it will not feel like the first one or the second one. With each one that goes by, it'll feel like a little more casual. It'll feel like they're a little bit less sorry, because in a very meaningful way, they are less sorry, because it's being reduced to a lesser of a deal each time you forgive them. Now, the final con I will say to remaining friends with people who display like these microaggressions or bigotry or racism is that you can never actually know people's true intentions. And so sometimes when you're in friendships like this, you can think that you're friends because you've got mutual respect for each other, you've got mutual love for each other, you have lots of things in common. Maybe you have the same ambitions or the same goals in life, or you have the same fundamental values, and that's what's drawing you together or keeping you together. But you can't actually know that. So if you think about somebody who has racist views or racist leanings, shall we say, or has like bigoted views that are deeply embedded into their psyche and into their worldview, you have to then question why they, and they always do this, by the way, they go out of their way to seek out people of color to be friends with. And by that, I mean that, for example, they might live in a very homogenous place. So for example, like my two microaggressive sort of semi-racist friends that I had all came from like really homogenous places. Like one of them grew up in like really I wouldn't say isolated part of Ireland, but it was very white. It was like 99.9999% white. And then the other person came from a part of Germany that was incredibly white, like 99.99% white. And so in this context, the fact that they have multiple people of color as friends makes me feel like they go out of their way to be friends with people of color because they're hard to come by. And so if you have this many, it means you're making an intentional effort to be friends with them. Now, that in itself is not a bad thing. We should strive to have diverse friends because they bring diverse experiences and worldview and outlook, and that can enrich our lives. It does enrich our lives. But in the context of the conversation that we're having, if somebody does display these negative emotions or negative values in terms of their bigotry or racism or microaggression, the fact that they have all these friends of color obviously is a question mark. And sometimes it can be very easy to believe that it's coming from an innocent place, but sometimes it isn't. Sometimes people surround themselves with other people because of the things that they give them. And let me take it out of this example first before I come back into it. So another example where people use other people for their own like reasons is when you think about like older men who choose to have younger women. It's not just because they're sexually exploiting the young women, as they often are. Check out my episode on age gap relationships. But it's also because they know that the young woman by his decrepit old side automatically communicates to other men that he's probably wealthy and probably powerful, because we all know the only reason why a young, beautiful woman would be like with an old, ugly man is because he's rich and powerful and she's clearly there for the money. So he's playing into the fact that we know that and choosing to have a young woman, a young, beautiful woman, because that's the message that he wants to communicate. So he's literally using her to communicate that element of himself, or that characteristic, or that image that he would like to portray to other people. Or if you think about when, my favorite subject, if you are somebody who wants to appear like incredibly smart, the fastest way to do that is to surround yourself with other smart people. So let's say hypothetically, you aren't like this scientist who can develop like this electric vehicle or battery storage or renewable energy technology because you don't have the training or background or the smarts, or you aren't this great inventor who can create like these great cars or design these great cars. You just don't have that in you. Well, the way you can get that by proxy is just by surrounding yourself with people who do have that. So let's say hypothetically you buy a company that already existed, that already did all those things, and then claim to have been the founder of that company. You automatically get to put on that persona. You get to pretend that you are this great innovator, this great scientist, this great designer. And if you didn't catch what I was putting down there, I was talking about Elon Musk. And so that's another example of like people using other people to imbue themselves with sort of like the characteristics that they would like other people or the outside world to perceive them as. A final example that's closer to what we're talking about here is when you think about celebrities who have experienced negative publicity or who are trying to do like an image rehabilitation to be perceived as good people. We know like the continent that they flock to and how they surround themselves with those like black and brown babies to essentially communicate that they're like out there like saving the wretched of the earth, you know, saving and administering medication to these poor kids who otherwise would die, you know. So they literally get to be like white saviors. And here I'm talking about Bill Gates, even though they've got no training in healthcare whatsoever, and they're actually in many ways doing a lot of harm. And so again, that's an example of surrounding yourself with a particular type of people so that you can communicate a particular type of image and be perceived in a particular type of way. Now, people also do that with people of color. So going back to the final point that I was saying of the cons is that you don't know what people's intentions are with you. And when somebody clearly is a racist person or has racist views or racist values or microaggressions or has bigoted values, but then they choose to surround themselves with people of color, sometimes it is because they're trying to virtue signal. They are literally using the people in their lives to communicate to their peers and to their network and their social network that either they are like good people or are better people than their network, or they're trying to like distance themselves from their own network. It's essentially saying, even though my social circle and family members maybe and other networks are racist, I'm not racist because I've got people of color. I'm friends with people of color. I am in relationships with people of color. So sometimes it's like they're trying to escape their background or their family or their sort of like negative history in a way by using you as evidence that they're not like the other white people in their lives, or they're not like the other white racist people in their lives. So sometimes you think you're just friends, but sometimes they're actually kind of using you to deny their background or to virtue signal to other people that they're good people. Sometimes as well, it's also because they fetishize you. Like, we're very used to talking about like fetishism. That's a word. I think that's a word. Fetishes when it comes to like interpersonal intimate relationships. So for example, like the white men who are obsessed with Asian women in a creepy way, like they fetishize Asian women because they've got this pornographic idea of what Asian women are like. Namely, they think they're like these, I would say, like passive, submissive women, essentially, that will just do anything that they ask for. Similarly, when it comes to like black women, they, like white men, will fetishize them and essentially like believe that they're like these red-blooded, hot-blooded women who are like ruled by their sexuality and are like very sexual and very passionate and very like keen, like aggressively keen for sex, essentially. So that's in the romantic context, but there's also fetishism, again, if that's a word, when it comes to like platonic relationships as well. Like those same people who are with you, who are friends with you for that reason, who like fetishize their like partners of color, if that's a word, if that's a term, they also extend that fetishism to friendships as well. So they'll often have like problematic views about your ethnicity or your background. So one of the things I've discovered with age is like they'll believe really weird things. Like, for example, they, when it comes to black people in particular, they often have this idea that you are like this happy, dancing, easy going, like uncomplex character. And so as long as you're happy and dancing and joking and like jovial and like high-fiving and high energy, it's like everything is great. You're exactly how they envision and how they imagine black people to be when they are like fetishize black people in a positive way, if I can say it that way. Although of course I know it's not positive, but when they have like these stereotypes that feel positive even though they're negative, that's often what they envision Africans or African Americans or black people to be like. It's almost like imagine like a rap video where it's taking place at like somebody's house party and everybody's having a great time. Like that's their idea of what blackness is like. And so they kind of think that by being friends with you, that that's what you're going to give them. Or other times, especially when it's friendships with men, like men and men, or when the person of color is a man, the white person will assume things about like blackness that can be like rooted in believing that there's edge or aggression or violence, and they're kind of attracted to that lifestyle. So they think that by being friends with you, they can have that. And so if you don't embody that, or if you don't show that, they're almost disappointed because they're kind of like, hang on a second, I thought all black men were like this, or I thought blackness meant this, and you're not giving that to me. So anyway, in both scenarios, both examples, it's basically fetishizing you in a platonic way. It isn't taking the form that we associate with fetishes in the romantic context, but it's very much still the same thing that's taking place. And so sometimes, like when you're friends with somebody who keeps doing these problematic things and saying these problematic things, it's because they're a racist. And just because they're friends with you, it doesn't prove or nullify the fact that they are a racist. It just means that they're a different type of racist. They're not the type of racist that will give you dirty look or not hire you or like, or be aggressive to you on the street or hostile to you or like be unwelcoming to you or try to get you fired. It's not that kind of form. It's the kind that fetishes you or fetishizes you. It's the kind that has this narrow, warped vision of what it means to be a black person, and they hope that by being in close proximity to you, they can have that narrow worldview like realized, essentially. They can have that be manifest in their relationship with you. Now, that was my 3 points on my cons list, and you probably know which side that I lean on. I clearly lean, at least on an intellectual level, putting into practice sometimes is always more difficult, especially when, like, as I said, you live in the West and a lot of your friends, probably especially in different contexts, are going to be white friends. So I don't know how practical it is to, like, ice everybody out who disappoints you or offends you or who's racist to you in these ways that I've spoken about. But certainly my takeaway, or what I know for sure in, like, at an intellectual level, is, like, there's no scenario in which there can be a meaningful or true relationship where there isn't safety. And when there is the presence of bigotry or racism or microaggression, it means obviously that the relationship isn't safe, because your emotions aren't safe, because your mental health isn't safe, because your psyche isn't safe with this person, because you're going to be on edge for the next time they say something hurtful or offensive or disrespectful or racist or microaggressive. So again, like, there is no safety in that friendship. And the safety isn't just actually even in the words that they say or the things that they say. It's also because the way that racism manifests in white liberal circles is that the person often denies, I mean, in all circles, I suppose, with racism, but the person often denies the fact that racism exists, or they minimize the existence of racism. And what that means is that not only is it difficult to point out when they're being racist to you because they fundamentally don't believe that it's that prevalent, it also means that they're likely to make decisions or do things that put you in physical danger. So if somebody doesn't believe in racism, that means that they can walk into a racist bar and not realize it's a racist bar and invite you as the only person of color to go with them to that place, that racist bar. Or they can invite you to somebody's home, to, like, a party, and not realize the dangers in you being there. And the thought that I just had was of this case a few years ago. Actually, let me look up her name real quick. So her name was Tamla Horsford. And this sticks in my mind because I remember looking at the picture, and it's one of the things that you just learn to know as a person of color. I remember looking at the picture and thinking of her. So the picture that often comes up when you look up the story is the woman is at a sleepover of moms. So there's, like, maybe 8 of them, and they're having a sleepover, and the woman, she's a black woman, she's sitting in the center of the picture. And when I first saw the picture, even before I read further into the story, automatically I remember thinking how all the other people who are paired together or in threes were leaning towards each other, or they were quite obviously comfortable with each other. Whereas the black woman in the center of the picture, she was leaning towards somebody, but the other person was leaning away from her. So I remember thinking how there wasn't closeness there in the same way that was present in the other pairs in the picture, if that makes sense. The second thing I remember thinking was, like, I personally wouldn't go to sleep at somebody's house now as an adult where I was the only person of color. I think that would be uncomfortable at the very least. And also I would think to myself, like, it's a very vulnerable position to be in. Anyway, in terms of the story, what happens is Tamla Horsford goes for a sleepover with a bunch of moms, like 7 or 8 other moms, and they've invited her over. She's brought, like, a drink. They're drinking. They're having a good time. But over the course of the evening, by the time early morning comes, Tamla is dead. She is found face down in the backyard, seemingly having fallen from, like, a second story balcony. And what's strange about the whole Tamla Horsford story is quite clearly she didn't die the way they said she died, because one, like, when they interviewed, like, the women differently, one of the things that emerged was that they didn't like her. Like, she had brought this tequila, I believe, and none of them wanted to drink it. None of them drank it. They also were making fun of her in all these different ways throughout the course of the evening. And it seemed that she spent a lot of the evening by herself, even though she had been invited here. And then on top of that, there was a discrepancy between the time that she was found and how long it took them to call the police. They also found like stuff on her body, like they found bruises on her bodies, on her body that implied that other things had taken place. Long story short, she clearly was in a group where she's the only Black woman in that group. She ends up being killed, and it emerges that they never liked her. And I would bet my bottom dollar on the fact that some of the stuff that they were saying was racialized. And so you might have a well-meaning, quote unquote, white friend who doesn't believe that racism is real, doesn't believe that it's that prevalent. And what they do is like they'll include you in situations, so they'll bring you into their circle, but their circle tent is filled with people who are racist or who have racist views or bigoted views. In other words, people who are unsafe for you to be around, especially in such a vulnerable situation in which you're going to be drinking a lot, you're going to be spending the night in their home, you're going to be surrounded by all these people without basically anybody potentially on your side. And so like this is just an example of how it's not just emotionally unsafe, but it can also be physically unsafe in like really important consequential ways. The other takeaway that I have from this is I kind of feel like for you to have a true connection with somebody, you have to have like intellectual parity. You have to be on the same wavelength intellectually. And the problem with people who are bigoted in whatever way is that fundamentally you are seeing the world in a completely different way. I personally like to think of it, and it helps me to be kind to think of it in this way. I think of it as like a mental disorder. I think of it as mental illness, because people who suffer from racism literally believe that by virtue of their skin color, that they are better. Even when like they have no scientific evidence to back that up, because the evidence isn't in their favor, but they have these beliefs because they've got white skin that somehow you deserve less rights, you should subjugate yourself to them, you should defer to them, they should have all the power, they should have all the money, they should get justice and freedom and all these like positive things that come from living in like a democratic world, but you're supposed to be like a second-class citizen. It's literally like a mental disorder. It's so silly that the only way you can rationalize it is that the person, there's something broken in their brain that causes them to think in this incredibly warped, dysfunctional way. And so how can you have a meaningful connection when one person's brain has been warped in this fundamental way where it warps how they see you, how they see people like you, how they see themselves, how they see the world, how they interpret things that happen in the world? All of those things are through that warped lens and through that warped mind. For me, I just don't think it's possible to have a meaningful connection on that basis. The other thing is that as far as them making like long-lasting changes, and the reason why, even though I said my pros list, you know, sometimes when you have like bigoted friends and they do things that are offensive or hurtful or racist or whatever, they can show a willingness and desire to change. I often feel like it's short-lived, and that short-livedness is not just a function of what I said earlier, in that their social network and the fabrics of their lives and the people who make up their lives often have the same social conditioning, and so it's very difficult for them to like overcome in one go. But it also comes from the fact that racism kind of serves them well in all these important ways. And that's like the part they don't want to say out loud. So ultimately, like, if you like live in a white country and that white country is wealthy, and I live in England, so obviously this is relevant here, but also the US, also Germany, also France, also literally most of the former colonial powers or current colonial powers, if you listen to my European Union episode. The thing is, on some level, at least I like to think, especially for this particular person I'm thinking about, they would know that the reason why like these countries are wealthy is directly connected to the reason why Black and brown countries are poor. And so they get to live in the abundance and in the spoils, shall we say, of colonialism and current neocolonialism. And they get to live lavishly. They get to live in a secure state. They get to have really good roads, really good opportunities here. They get to have really good defense systems. They get to have great trade agreements. All these different components they get to benefit from. Not to say, like, at a micro level, things like knowing that if you ever go, or for the most part, when you go against a person of color, like for like, you're probably going to get the opportunity. Or there's lots of beneficial assumptions made about you. So one of the things I think often is how we give a lot of benefit of the doubt to, like, white men in suits. I mean, I will say men in suits in general, but specifically and in particular, white men in suits, where you make assumptions about, like, their intelligence or their intellect, about their capabilities, about their experience, about their power, about the things that they're just capable of. And those things largely are not just made because the person's wearing a suit, because it also applies when they're not wearing a suit, but it applies because you're thinking about their whiteness. So if we make assumptions about all kinds of people. And so if you accept that, for example, we make assumptions about Asian women or Black women or South Asian women or Black men, we also make assumptions about white men, and they're overwhelmingly positive assumptions for the most part. Literally, Jesus is white. They've made the white man God. And listen to my episode actually about, I forgot what the episode title is, but it's talking about Christianity. It's white Jesus, the episode's on white Jesus. And so you have a situation in which the embodiment of power, of light, of eternity, of goodness, of rules, of control, of the creator is literally in the white man's image. All those things have, like, a trickle-down effect on how they view themselves and their psyche. And that's what emboldens them. That's what makes them feel so entitled. Because society and the world all day long tells them all these great positive things about themselves. And so, again, when it comes to interpersonal relationships, and you're friends with, like, somebody, a white person who's displaying microaggressions or bigotry or racism, you're like the annoying aunt that's, like, picking at them. Like, the rest of the world is telling them how great they are, and here you are, this annoying, like, clawing, irritating flea that's telling them about the bad things that they're doing. Of course it serves their interest to, like, ignore you or to minimize what you're saying or to minimize the impact or implication of what you're saying, because it makes them feel better not to do so, because it allows them to be able to, like, tap into fully. It allows them to completely bathe in the image that the world, like, projects back onto them, or at least the white world projects back onto them. So again, it's like, it's a zero-sum game. It's kind of like, you know, they could change their worldview and, like, change who they are and, like, learn to, in a meaningful way, in an enduring way, to stop being racist and stop being bigoted. But it probably feels very, very good to, like, not do that, because it allows them to have all these other things that I've just described. Now, the final takeaway before I conclude is I personally think that it's not up to, and I know I talked about earlier about the power of forgiveness and the power of, like, bringing people in as opposed to, like, calling them out, and how that can lead to transformative change. Sure, but I don't know if I agree that that's the job of people of color. One, because of what I said earlier about the power of diminishing return or diminishing gratefulness for your forgiveness. Like, the more you forgive them, the less they take what you're saying seriously. But also because there's one of the things that people don't focus on or talk about is the mental health and the psychological damage that comes from experiencing a hostile world on a daily basis. So just like I said, like, racism, at least in the context that I live in places like London, in, like, a pretty suburban place, it just takes a very different form. It isn't people like putting out nooses or calling you the N-word, although that has happened as well. It is mostly stuff that I've described elsewhere in the episode. It's stuff that chips away at your dignity. It's stuff that chips away at your identity, at your self-esteem, at your positivity, at that sort of like causes you to take a little like step back, like it's a little cut. But the thing is, you're getting lots of those cuts on a daily basis. You might leave your house and you are walking, and I'm a generally smiley person, but like every person you or most of the people you come across are like hostile to you, or they're like not smiling to you, and you initially think, before you realize that it is you, you initially think that like people are just not smiley to each other, but then you realize they're just not smiley to you. Or for example, you go to a restaurant or a cafe and you're ordering, but they're looking at your white partner as though you're not speaking. Or let's say, for example, you're watching films, you're on Netflix, you're scrolling trying to find for stuff, and you just choose like a generic show. Like there's generic in the sense that it's one of those mass-produced Netflix shows that you're never going to remember like 3 minutes from now after you finish watching it. And then while you're watching it, there'll just be like random racism that doesn't serve the plot, doesn't serve the story, isn't relevant to the story. They just think it's okay to just be casually racist. Or you'll be having a conversation with your friend on the phone and they'll just casually say something microaggressive when you weren't expecting it. Or you're going into work and you're getting your review, your annual review, and your manager is describing you as like being like unfriendly or being like unwelcoming, when all you've done is just be yourself and be as warm as any other tosser in that place, but somehow they're pathologizing your existence. My point is, there's all kinds of ways on a daily basis in which this world is trying to bring you down. You know, the white world is trying to bring you down energetically, emotionally, psychologically, and that has a toll on your mental health. It has a toll on your psyche. It has a toll on how confident or happy or at ease or peaceful you can have. It can also make you angry. It can have these bubbling feelings that you've got to suppress because God forbid you should be the angry black person. All of this is to say that you don't then, on top of all of this, have to take on the burden of like teaching white people not to be racist or microaggressive or not to be bigoted. I think what you should do, what is better or what should be done, is that's what other white people do for other white people, if that makes sense. Like, obviously, there's a limited context in which you will have to explain things. There are some people you will have to say some things because those people are going to be part of your life forever. Let's say, for example, you've got family members that are white. You obviously can't afford to ice them out. So for those people, you will have to explain those things. But for the most part, it shouldn't feel like it's your burden or your responsibility or your job to go around constantly explaining and teaching and like imbuing this knowledge to people who are hurting you. Because one, nobody's looking out for you and your mental health. And also two, it costs you a great deal to do that. And what it's costing you is that if you are teaching somebody to do something or to be in a different way, you necessarily have to suppress your anger and your emotions and your needs so that they can learn. Because people don't tend to learn in a high stress, high emotion situation. So you have to suppress your energy and stifle your feelings so that you can even impart that information. You also have to be kind to the person who's just abused you racially. And that's kind of doing more damage to your own psyche. Most situations, you don't have to be nice to your abuser. Racism is one of the only, actually, and homophobia and sexism. So maybe let me walk that back, but it's doubly damaging when somebody racially abuses you or abuses you in a bigoted way in some way, and then it falls on you to then teach that abuser how not to be abusive. So I will say the best scenario, and I don't know how practical it is, but as far as possible, I don't think it should fall on us to constantly correct these people, especially when they've got to be like, they gotta be like spectacular, amazing, phenomenal friends. I'm not talking about just like friends who like, oh, we have a nice chat. I mean, this person will like kill for you. Okay, I don't mean actually kill for you, but I mean, this person will like go to the nth degree for you. This person has proven themselves in the past about the lengths they will go to like help you or protect you or do things for you or be your friend or support you. If that's that kind of friend, okay, maybe you can make an allowance and you could like, there could be a few teachable moments here and there. But if it is somebody where the extent of your friendship is like you've had nice conversations and you've gone to nice bars together, or you've taken a couple of nice holidays, then I personally don't think that person is worth it. It's not worth it because the cost to you and your mental health and your well-being and your dignity, honestly, it's a high price to pay. Anyway, all this is to say, I'm not going to say that I land definitively 100% to like on just Xing out these people, because again, like I said, this conversation, at least for me, takes place as a person of color, as a Black person living in a white country, and I'm going to be here for the foreseeable future. So it's just not practical. However, where it is possible, or when the infringement is consistent or has been more than like twice, I think it's not worth keeping the friendship. It's not worth keeping the friendship because, as I said, what kind of connection can you have when you're operating from two different realities, when there is no emotional safety, when it benefits the person to remain ignorant because their life is much more comfortable, and where the onus is always on you to sort of be the person who's teaching them or who's doing the teaching? It's like a high price to pay, and a lot of the time it honestly isn't worth it. So up to everybody, I guess, to decide what their threshold is, but it better be a spectacular, amazing, like one in a million friendship to make it worthwhile. And so with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in and for bearing with my hoarse throat, my croaky throat. I getting over a flu, as I said. Also, this again is coming out after midnight, so technically it's not Monday, it's technically Tuesday. I'm sorry about that. I've gotten to the habit of recording late, but I hope you forgive me and hope you enjoyed the episode and were able to listen to the very end. And with that, I'll catch you next Monday/maybe Tuesday if it's after midnight.